Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is Wednesday, August the 21st, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can also leave us a message at pcradioshow.org with your questions or comments. It's been reported that Facebook paid contractors to transcribe users' audio chats. Facebook has been paying hundreds of outside contractors to transcribe clips of audio from users of its services, according to people with knowledge of the work. The work has rattled the contract employees, who are not told where the audio was recorded or how it was obtained. "Only to transcribe it," said the people, who requested anonymity for fear of losing their jobs. They're hearing Facebook uses conversations, sometimes with vulgar content, but do not know why Facebook needs them transcribed, the people said. Facebook said, "They don't touch your content. Your content is not what they look at. Then why are they transcribing it?" Do you know what Facebook's doing? Do you know how Facebook is using your data? Do you know how Facebook is handling your privacy? Microsoft is sounding a red alert to Windows 10 users, warning them to update their operating systems immediately. The company, in a blog posted last week, warned of two critical vulnerabilities that rival the previous Bluekeep crisis. As with that bug, the new issues are described as wormable, meaning hackers could use them to spread malware from one machine to another without any interaction from the user. Microsoft said so far it has no evidence that the vulnerabilities were known to any third parties. It is important that affected systems are patched as quickly as possible because of the elevated risk associated with wormable vulnerabilities like these. Customers who have automatic updates enabled are automatically protected by these fixes. If you don't have automatic updates enabled, you can search for the patch by typing Windows Update in the search bar from the system's Start menu, Start Bar. The vulnerabilities are only present in Windows 10, which runs on more than 800 million devices today. Older systems such as Windows XP are not affected. The comparisons to Bluekeep underscore how serious Microsoft is taking these security flaws. That flaw was deemed so serious that National Security Agency got involved to warn people to update their systems. What is account sharing? Account sharing is when multiple people are using a single account to access streaming video services. Disney and Charter Communications are teaming up to fight this. The battle against account sharing was announced as Disney and the nation's second biggest cable company struck a new distribution agreement involving Disney's Hulu, ESPN Plus, and the forthcoming Disney Plus. Customers could still buy those online services directly from Disney, but the new deal would also let them make those purchases through Charter's Spectrum TV service. If you buy a Disney service through Charter, be aware that the companies will work together to prevent you from sharing a login with friends. Disney and Charter said that the announcement was such that they agreed to work together on piracy mitigation. The two companies will work together to implement business rules and techniques to address such issues as unauthorized access and password sharing. In addition to streaming services, the deal will let Charter continue carrying Disney-owned TV channels on its cable service. That includes ABC, the various Disney and ESPN channels, FX, National Geographic, and more. This agreement will allow Spectrum to continue delivering to its customers popular Disney content makes possible future distribution by Spectrum of Disney streaming services and will begin an important collaborative effort to address the significant issue of piracy mitigation. The announcement didn't say exactly how the companies will fight account sharing, nor would they give technical details how it will work. The crackdown could target people who use Charter TV account logins to sign into Disney services online. Charter has complained about account sharing several times over the past few years, while criticizing TV networks for not fully locking down their content. There's a lot of extra streams, there's a lot of extra passwords, and there's a lot of people who could get free services. Charter argues that password sharing has helped people avoid buying cable TV. ESPN has also complained about account sharing, calling it piracy. Another possibility is that Charter could monitor usage of its broadband network to help Disney fight account sharing. For example, Disney could track the IP addresses of users signing into its services, and Charter could match those IP addresses to those of its broadband customers. Charter has plenty of leeway to share its customers' private browsing data because Congress has eliminated broadband piracy rules in 2017. Customers could use VPN services to attempt to avoid detection, though. Charter has 15.8 million residential TV customers nationwide, making it the second biggest cable TV service after Comcast, but it lost 400,000 video customers in the past year. Charter's broadband service has gone in the other direction, rising from 23.1 million to 24.2 million residential customers in the past year. Netflix and HBO takes less strict approach. In contrast to Charter and Disney, Netflix and HBO haven't cared as much as about account sharing. Sharing a Netflix account with individuals beyond your household does violate Netflix's term of use, but the restriction isn't heavily enforced. Password sharing is something you have to learn to live with because there's so much legitimate password sharing like you share with your spouse with your kids. Password sharing is a terrific marketing vehicle for the next generation of viewers. Netflix, HBO, and Hulu all limit the number of concurrent streams on each account. However, that doesn't prevent account sharing entirely, but such a policy can make it inconvenient to share an account with a bunch of friends. Welcome to the world of technology. Microsoft drops Office 2019 from home use program. The company is moving away from perpetual license of Office 2019 and now offers annual subscriptions to Office 365 Personal and Office 365 Home. As expected, Microsoft has dumped a perpetual license Office 2019 from its home use program agreements with organizations that license the productivity software for the workplace. Home use program is one of the benefits provided by the software assurance, which in turn either included with some office licensing categories or optional with others. Although software assurance may be best known for granting upgrade rights to the next version of a perpetual license, such as Office 2019, it also is included with some subscription-based licensing of, for instance, Office 365 or its more inclusive big sister, Microsoft 365. The idea is let the employees buy the same Office suite that they use at work, then run the suite on their home PC. Employers like the idea because it implicitly encourages employees to work at home. The home use program has long offered employees of eligible organizations discounts on perpetual Office licenses. Those purchased with one-time payments that grant the user rights to use the software as long as desired. Theoretically, forever. But earlier this year, Microsoft modified the home use program to offer consumer-grade subscriptions to Office 365 as well. At the same time, Microsoft made clear that the one PC per license deals were obsolete and likely to be retired from the home use program. Well, it's now been retired. Office Professional Plus 2019 and Office Home and Business 2019 are no longer available as home use program offers. Instead, Microsoft offered annual subscriptions to Office 365 Personal and Office 365 Home for $70 and $49, respectively, which is at a 30% discount. Subscriptions purchased through Home Use Program will extend existing personal and home plans the employee may already have and once bought at the discount, or future renewals will be at the lower price, even if the buyer no longer works for the organization. The only requirement is that you maintain recurring billing on your subscription. The move is in step with Microsoft's emphasis on Office 365 and its rent, not buy model. Although Microsoft continues to offer perpetual licenses in several forms and has pledged to follow Office 2019 with at least one successor, the company has made no bones about preferring to sell recurring subscriptions. More information about the Home Use Program and instructions on how to determine eligibility can be found on the Microsoft website. Microsoft has stripped the perpetually licensed Office 2019 from Home Use Program benefit that many organizations enjoy. Instead, it now offers eligible employees consumer-grade Office 365 subscriptions at a 30% discount. Ohio State University wants to trademark the word THE, T-H-E. Ohio State University has reportedly filed an application with the U.S. Patent Trademark Office for a trademark on one of the English language oldest words. The filing was made on August the 8th by Buckeye officials, shows the school intends to use the word THE on a line of t-shirts, baseball caps, and hats. Like other institutions, Ohio State works to vigorously protect the university's brand and trademarks. These assets hold significant value, says Ohio State, which benefits our students and faculty and the broader community by supporting our core academic mission of teaching and research. The application for the trademark was filed by the university in an effort to protect its brand. The application was first spotted by trademark lawyer Josh Gerben, who said in a video posted online that the university's application has issues out of the gate. In order for a trademark to be registered for a brand of clothing, the trademark must be used in a trademark fashion. In other words, it has to be used on tagging or labeling for the products. In this case, just putting the word THE on the front of a hat or on the front of a shirt is not sufficient trademark. This isn't the first time Ohio State has filed for an unusual trademark. They've also trademarked the names and likeness of football coaches like Urban Meyer and Woody Hayes, as well as phrases like Script Ohio and The Shoe. I guess if they're successful with trademarking the word THE, we might have a problem with the Big Apple. Hey, the Big Apple's New York. The FAA says some MacBook Pros shouldn't be taken on airplanes. Apple recently recalled select laptops over battery fire risk. U.S. airline safety regulators banned select MacBook Pro laptops on flights after Apple recently said that some units had batteries that posed a fire risk. In a statement, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration said it was aware of the recalled batteries that are used in some Apple MacBook Pro laptops and stated that it alerted major U.S. airlines about the recall. The watchdog also reminded airlines to follow 2016 safety instructions for goods with recalled batteries, which means that the affected Apple laptops should not be taken on flights as cargo or in carry-on baggage by passengers. The European Union Aviation Safety Agency issued a warning about these MacBook Pro models earlier this month, telling airlines in the region to follow 2017 rules that require devices with recalled lithium-ion batteries to be switched off and not used during flights. The Apple laptops in question are some 15-inch MacBook Pros sold between September 2015 and February 2017. Apple issued a recall in June, saying it had determined that in a limited number of older generation 15-inch MacBook Pro units, the battery may overheat and pose a fire-risky risk. Four airlines with cargo operations managed by Total Cargo Expertise, that's TUI Group Airlines, implemented a ban barring the laptops from being brought onto the carrier's planes as cargo, according to an internal notice obtained by Bloomberg News. Note that 15-inch Apple MacBook Pro laptops sold between mid-2015 to February 2017 is prohibited on board any of our mandate carriers, a TCE operations coordinator wrote to employees. A spokesperson for TUI Group Airlines said airport staff and flight attendants will start making announcements about these MacBook Pros at the gate and before takeoff. Laptops that have replaced batteries won't be impacted. The company also posted a notice on the website banning the recalled computers on board in both cargo and passenger areas of its planes. It's unclear what efforts will, if any, be made in U.S. airports. Customer safety is always Apple's top priority, and they said they have voluntarily decided to replace affected batteries free of charge. Apple said in a June statement that once new batteries are installed in laptops, customers are free to fly with their computers. According to the Canadian notice from June, about 432,000 MacBook Pros sold in the United States were included in the recall. Roughly 26,000 units sold in Canada were impacted too, while the number sold in Europe hasn't been disclosed. In a July 10th tweet following an incident involving a MacBook, the FAA said recalled batteries do not fly. The MacBook Pro isn't the first consumer tech device to be barred from airlines in 2016. Samsung Electronics Note 7 was banned from the U.S. flights due to fire hazard after the handset battery exploded in multiple incidences. Recently, recalled laptops like those from HP may also be banned by the FAA rules. While there have been repeated incidents of phones, laptops, and other devices overheating and catching fire in passenger compartments of planes, it hasn't ever caused a fire to spread. The flames can be extinguished with water, and flight attendants are trained how to address this. There have been at least three accidents, two of them fatal, on cargo airlines since 2006, in which lithium batteries were suspected of helping spread fires. Stricter rules on shipping them have been introduced since then. U.S. aviation regulations prohibit carrying recalled batteries on flights unless they have been replaced or stored in special packages that prohibits fires. These are according to FAA guidelines on hazardous materials. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on the subject of LinkedIn.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm here to give you some benefit from my experience over the years of being an IT professional. And one of the areas that people reach out to me and discuss with me, and I hear this all the time, the LinkedIn thing, do I really need to be a part of it? And the answer is yes. If you are in the professional world in any shape, any form, any manner whatsoever, you want to be part of LinkedIn. LinkedIn, yes, it has a certain social media aspect to it. It is like Facebook, but for professionals. But you have to be very careful. You have to work this out appropriately. This isn't where you're connecting with your friends. You're not connecting with your neighbors. You're not connecting with all of the different people in your life. You're connecting with people who see you in the workplace. And this comes into play, especially when you're job hunting, especially when you are searching for the next good job. And this also helps other people who you know, who you've worked with, who you've mentored or learned from over the many years. So you can help people get a better job. You can help yourself get a better job. You get to keep in that business frame of mind. Now, LinkedIn is not the end-all, be-all for job hunting, for getting your next job. It is just a start. Now, the big thing with this, we used to network. It used to be that you would go out and you would you'd have your friends and you would work with them and you would move on to the next business, the next job, and you would keep track of all of your friends and you would help each other get a new job. You'd be a reference for someone, something like that. However, our networks are expected to be much larger. And in the day and age when we have technology at our fingertips, when we can work with this technology to keep in touch with a lot of people, it works out really well. You can maintain your vast network of people just by occasionally posting on LinkedIn business items. I mean, look, you want to be professional on LinkedIn. It's not like Facebook. You're not posting about your family. You're not posting all kinds of weird, funny jokes or something like that. You want to highlight the latest article from the LA Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the whatever newspaper, as long as it's a business-related item. So you can repost those and you can keep current. You can basically look to others like you're staying hip and current with technology. And that's good. And that is really exciting. So all of this gets put together and that helps you grow your network. You get all of these different contacts. And then maintain them. You keep in a minor light touch with them. That way when you post, hey, I know someone who is looking for a job doing this, you're helping somebody else out. Hey, the people see that. They recognize that. Hey, I need a job. People see that. And yes, they will step forward and they will assist you. This is the information age. So we need to connect up. We need to be reaching out to other people. And also as part of this, we develop a professional personal brand. A personal brand? Okay, yes. We recognize McDonald's. We recognize Starbucks. We recognize Microsoft and all of these major brands. And yet, if we neglect our own brand, well, we get lost in the mix. There's an interesting thing as far as branding. I go by Benjamin Rockwell. I've been doing that for many years. That is my professional brand name. Now, there are Ben Rockwells out there. There are also Benjamin Rockwells. There are also Benny Rockwells and Benji Rockwells out there on the internet. By branding myself as Benjamin Rockwell, you will always find me out there on the internet, or most of the time, I wind up being in the top few spots if you search for me on the internet. That is a branding. You need to be doing the same thing. LinkedIn allows you to set up that brand and control the information that's going out about you. You get to put a much larger resume out there. You get to highlight a lot of the key bits and pieces of information, and you get to sell you. That whole Got Milk commercial, remember that from a few years ago, and it continues even as a meme today. Well, yes, you can continue your own version like that. And above all, the biggest thing to remember is LinkedIn accounts for a big chunk. And there are various numbers out there that people throw out and say, oh, yeah, LinkedIn, you've got to have this many contacts and you've got to LinkedIn provides this percentage of the jobs just by being friends on LinkedIn. And I ignore the statistics on that. I just know that LinkedIn is the place you want to be. So, yes, being on LinkedIn is important. Don't neglect it. Leverage it. Use it for your best personal purposes that you can. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Chromebooks use a lightweight operating system designed to get people online faster, without having to wait around for the computer to start up. Much of the heavy lifting on Chromebooks get done on Chrome's remote servers, so Chromebooks themselves don't need fast chips or lots of storage. They're easier for classrooms to share. Just sign in with a Google account and a student's apps and documents instantly appear. Teachers also have online tools to lock down what apps and sites students can use. And with models available for less than $200, schools can get a few Chromebooks for the price of an iPad or a rival laptop. But Chromebook's success story in schools is largely an American one, and it's likely to stay that way. Chromebooks are useless in China because the device depends on Google services that aren't available there. And in emerging countries where a budget laptop would be ideal, the internet access isn't reliable enough. A typical Windows 10 laptop unit is better for many creative tasks, such as recording and editing movies, and to be able to do your income tax returns. There is no income tax return application for a Chromebook. Students studying engineering, robotics, and graphics won't be able to use Chromebooks to run the kind of specialized software that's available for Macs and Windows laptops. But what is little known is the expected product life of a Chromebook. Google states the expected useful lifetime for a new Chromebook is 6.5 years from date of release. Notice I use the term release and not purchase. This means that the operating system version itself was released and not necessarily gone into production yet. That's when the product life cycle starts. So that 6.5 years is really not realistic. This is documented by Google end-of-life policy. In other words, a Chromebook will receive Chrome's OS for at least 6.5 years from date of release. And if you're interested in purchasing a Chromebook, I recommend you only consider a new unit. I wouldn't buy a used unit or refurb unit or discontinued model. What could happen if you use your Chromebook after its end-of-life policy and the date has expired? Essentially, your Chromebook would stop being able to support the security software updates released after its end of life has passed. Google has extended the lifetime of the Chromebook from 3 to 5 to now 6.5 years currently. There are so many options when it comes to buying a new computer these days. One popular option is the Google Chromebook. These are sub-$250 laptops that you can also get for under $200 that runs Google's Chrome OS, which is an operating system version of the popular Chrome browser. However, there is a downfall to buying one that you need to know. Chrome OS works similarly to Windows with a start button, taskbar, and apps, so you can pick it up quickly. Most of the time, it's as easy to use as a standard web browser. Plus, it can do many of the same things other operating systems can do, like video chat, play music, print documents, and play games. Starting with the first quarter of 2016, Chromebooks have outsold Apple Macs in the United States. Nearly 2 million were sold in 2016 during that time frame. Unfortunately, Google has an end-of-life policy that makes your Chromebook obsolete after 6.5 years. What that means is that the product model is considered obsolete and automatic software updates from Google are no longer guaranteed. They may extend it, but there's no guarantee. The tech giant says Chrome OS devices, along with Chromebooks, are only guaranteed to receive 6.5 years of support, and that's, of course, from date of release, not from date of purchase. Those devices could stop receiving security and feature updates at that point. Hey, that's pretty serious stuff. Google will not guarantee that unsupported system will run properly or safely at that point. You should get a notification on your Chromebook when it stops receiving updates. Due to security risk, Google says it would be a good idea to replace your Chromebook. Of course, from their point of view, you go buy a new one. Once you stop getting security updates, your system is susceptible to exploits that are not patched. One thing people don't often realize is that the end-of-life date does not begin on the date you purchase your laptop. It actually begins on the date the laptop was manufactured. it is possible that this policy will change in the future. Google says it's working with its partners, trying to update policies that would allow them to extend updates past the end-of-life date. By the way, if you want to find out what the end-of-life is on your Chromebook, do a search on Chromebook end-of-life policy, and you should be able to get a website that will give you all the information. What could happen if you use your Chromebook after its end-of-life policy? Well, essentially, your Chromebook would stop being able to support the security software updates released after its end-of-life has passed. Google, however, has extended the lifetime of the Chromebook from 3 to 5 to 6.5 years now. It's long been possible to run Linux on a Chromebook. That should not come as a surprise, but doing it wasn't easy. Then Google announced it was bringing a completely integrated Linux desktop to the Chromebook. Well, they're working on it. Google is responsible for getting computers into the hands of more and more people. They subsidize the cost of Chromebooks, and as a result, more people have laptops. Trouble is, the operating system on these Chrome devices are locked down. They don't respect user privacy, and they don't have a lot to offer outside of a web browser. If you've unlocked the bootloader on your Chrome device and want to replace the operating system, Linux is the best choice. Linux operating systems are free and will run on anything, well, almost anything. And here are the best Linux distributions to install on a Google Chromebook. Gallium OS. Gallium OS is a Linux distribution that is specifically designed for Chromebooks and Chrome devices in general. Lubuntu, that's L-U-B-U-N-T-U. There's Bunsen Labs Linux and Arch Linux. Good luck. Last year, Google surprised Linux geeks the world over with a feature that lets Chromebook users run desktop Linux apps on Chrome OS. The feature, dubbed Crustini at the time, but now known by the catching title Linux Beta for Chromebooks, continues to improve with each new development update to Chrome OS. For instance, it would soon add graphics acceleration. But Google isn't stopping there. The search giant now plans to extend the Linux beta for Chromebooks feature to allow device managers to choose a Linux distro on which it runs. As one distro does not fit all, this is an important development for developers in particular. Someone working in the worlds of Red Hat want or prefer a set of tools, setup, or distro-specific software configured in a certain way. Similarly, someone else working with Snap apps on Ubuntu may prefer having an Ubuntu more beneficial while hacking around with Ubuntu-specific technologies. As per the website 9to5 Google, they spotted this change in Chromium codebase. Device administrators will be able to designate a URL for Chrome OS to download the Linux distro from a hash to ensure the download was successful. It also intended for a license key, if that was necessary, to be preset. It's not yet known if any modifications will need to be made to the Linux distro itself to work with Chrome OS. Right now, the feature appears to be limited to manage Chrome OS devices and device admins. There isn't, at present, a method for non-managed users to select or choose a Linux distro using the feature which has the codename PETA. But with this entire effort being a developer-oriented one, it's a allure for those who think you can't code on a Chromebook. Surely it makes sense to allow developers to pick and choose their own flavor of Linux. This is great for hackers. If you have an older system that is just taking up space, download a Linux distro from distrowatch.org. Install it onto a USB flash drive, and you can run the selected Linux distro to see if you want to use it. In this manner, you don't have to install and replace your existing system. I welcome listeners to send in their comments to hank@pcradioshow.org as to how you are utilizing the netbook that you may have converted into a Linux system. What distro are you using and why it best suits your needs? Me? Am I using any Linux distro? Of course I am. What am I using? Well, that's another subject for another day. Google announced that it is bringing a new font to Docs, Sheets and Slides that was explicitly designed to improve reading speeds. The new font is called Lexend, L-E-X-E-N-D, and it was developed by Thomas Jochen, who is probably best known for his Quicksand font. While Google stresses how this will benefit students, most of us could probably benefit from a font to help us read faster. To do this, the Lexend family, which comes in 8 variations, doesn't do anything fancy with the actual form of the letters. Indeed, it's a pretty standard variable sans serif font. But Hocken applied data from a number of in-depth studies, which themselves were based on the research of Bonnie Shaver Troop. The fact that it's sans serif already reduces noise, making it faster to scan the letters, and in addition, using variable font technology. Lexend features expanded character spacing and font outline shapes. To try these new fonts, you first have to head to the font menu in the toolbar and look for the More Fonts option. From there, you can search for Lexend, and once you've found it, add the new font to your list of saved fonts for use in Docs, Sheets, and Slides. Google Work is the main company, not work with border agencies. U.S. Customs and Border Protection are looking for cloud suppliers. Employees have led multiple campaigns to shape Google's actions. Some Google employees are called on the company to publicly promise not to work with U.S. immigration authorities, which they said are abusing human rights. U.S. Customs and Border Protection recently said it was looking for proposals from companies to supply it with cloud computing services. Google is a leading cloud provider. Activists and politicians have accused the agency of human rights abuses along the border with Mexico. The agency has separated children from their families and is detaining migrants for indefinite periods of time. The Google workers have a petition with 70 employee signatures. They want the company to commit to not bidding on the contract, as well as to refuse to work on projects for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Spokesman for the Customs and Border Protection didn't immediately return requests for comments. This group demand that Google publicly commit not to support CPB, ICE, or ORR with any infrastructure funding or engineering resources, directly or indirectly, until they stop engaging in human rights abuses. By any interpretation, CBP and ICE are in grave violation of the international human rights law, as quoted by this group. Google employees have led multiple public campaigns to shape the company's behavior over the last 2 years. A major walkout last year eventually led to the company stopping its practice of making employees sign away their rights to bring claims against it in court. Google also didn't renew a contract to supply the U.S. military with artificial intelligence technology after outrage from employees. What makes this news item not really newsworthy at all is that Google has over 100,000 employees and only 70 employees signed this petition, and this has grabbed the headline as the employees of Google are making this demand. This is such a small percentage of people, they do not represent the entire base of employees. But yet, they grab this headline and make it publicly available, and the mainstream news media treats this as a big item of importance. 70 people? If 70 people made a demand on Google to do something, something as outrageous as that they must give every employee 6 months of vacation out of every year, and the only 70 people made that the petition, would it get the same headline? No, this is not responsible reporting at all. I have replaced the incandescent bulbs with LED bulbs rated between 15,000 to 22,000 hours throughout the house. Some of these LED replacement bulbs already needed replacement in less than a year. Trying to figure out how many lumens are needed to replace the standard incandescent bulb is frustrating. No two manufacturers have the same lumen specs equivalents for a 40, 60, 75, and a 100-watt bulb. It seems a lumen's rating for brightness is not linear as with the old-fashioned incandescent bulb on watts. I have no confidence on the quality of today's LED bulbs. Now I have to be concerned with the size and shape of the LED bulbs. I guess I'm just a Luddite. Marty, please give me some words of wisdom.
Do you know what's inside an LED light bulb? Okay, LEDs, that's an obvious guess, I guess. Now look, for anybody who doesn't care to memorize every three-letter acronym that comes along, I'll just whisper that LED stands for light-emitting diode. Now these are generally small electronic components, usually smaller than a kernel of corn, many as small as the beads on a keychain. Most LED bulbs have several of these tiny light emitters inside, but that's not all that has to fit in there. They're wired together with other electronic components like resistors and capacitors, and together they act as a power adapter. So the 120 volts at your wall socket can be dropped to a voltage that's less destructive to the little LEDs. There could be more electronics in there too. Bulbs that change colors, or that let you choose which flavor of white they put out, or the dim, or that your home automation can control. Well, things like that mean fitting even more electronics inside, and in some cases, multiple sets of LED emitters. So, to use a more familiar metaphor, inside an LED bulb, things could be as simple as getting a plain bagel, or one with just sesame seeds, or one with just salt. But sometimes it's more like an everything bagel inside, and sometimes even worse, more like an onion-packed bialy. Sorry if I'm making anybody hungry, it was a metaphor. I don't recommend trying to eat any light bulbs. But the question I want to address is simply why some LED bulbs die young. Weren't we promised they'd be good for 20 years or more? What's breaking that promise? Or was there something weaselly about that promise in the first place? Before I get into fingering fibbers, let me get into what's most likely to make an LED bulb fail. The main failure factors are dirty power, compromised components, and cheapskate manufacturing. Before we're done, I hope to share ways to avoid all three. Let's start with dirty power. I don't know of any LED bulbs that build in surge protection, but hey, if you do, please get in touch. Tell me about them. The diode emitters themselves might get blown by a big surge or a spike, but most of the time, they'll just get a little too hot. That's not insignificant. Heat is a known cause of reduced life expectancy for many active electronic components. And recurring surges can keep whittling away at how much longer a bulb will live. Spikes or surges are harmful, but brownouts aren't terrible. They may make the bulbs flicker and reduce their brightness, but brownouts are not doomsday events for LED bulbs. The one kind of component inside an LED bulb that's most likely to fail, to itself die young and take the bulb down with it, is the, you don't have to memorize this term, the electrolytic capacitor. That's in the part that helps adapt line voltage to what the LEDs need. Now, that is especially true when the manufacturer cuts corners. Let me explain that. Electrolytic capacitors are a little bit like a jelly roll made with something like wax paper and something like foil, and they have voltage ratings that are largely based on the thickness of the metal foil used in making them. Too high a voltage punches through, and the thing fails. Higher voltage ratings also come with slightly higher price tags and slightly larger sizes. When manufacturers order electrolytic capacitors for assembling their LED bulbs, the good ones overspecify, and the penny pinchers buy components that are just barely enough to work at first. That's what I mean by compromised components. It's also what I mean by compromised manufacturing, but there's another side to that epithet. Consider this question. How long do you expect an LED bulb to keep working? Almost all of the early bulbs you could buy, starting with a breakthrough $60 Cree bulb way back when, well, they almost always rated those bulbs at 25,000 hours of service. And they translated that into more than 22 years. But that's a little sketchy. It's based on a government standard that says the bulb's stated life expectancy should stipulate it's based on 3 hours per day of use. Many bulbs, real life, they burn 5 to 12 hours per day. Adjusting the math can take the idea of decades off the table. But there's something even sneakier. The bulb makers know that most shoppers never read the specs on the package. Never read them. The last time you bought LED bulbs, did you pay any attention to the claimed life expectancy? We're long past the era of $60 LED bulbs. Most are less than $5, and some are under $2. One way to get there is to build it for a shorter life. You may expect 25,000 hours, but read the packaging now. A lot of those bulbs are rated at 20,000 hours, or 15,000 hours, or 12,000 hours, or 10,000 hours, or even as little as 7,000 or 8,000 hours. That's not 25, is it? 10,000 hours at 10 hours per day is 1,000 days, or about 33 months. That's less than 3 years. So some LED bulbs die young because they're built to die young. There's something else that you may not have known to look for on the package. Is a bulb for indoor use only? Is it okay in damp locations, in wet locations, at extended temperatures? How about outdoors? Maybe the most confusing number on the package is lumens. Here's the bottom line on that. It's misleading. Not for any evil reason, but because it's more about physics than about math. It started with measurements on old-fashioned incandescent bulbs, and most 60-watt bulbs delivered more or less 800 lumens. But today, an LED bulb package might claim 60-watt equivalents for anything in a range of 730 to 900 lumens. You might see bulbs with anything from 1,300 to 1,700 lumens identified as being in the 100-watt class. Don't memorize that. It's just quite a range. And then there's the whole thing about color temperature. How the heck can anybody make a rational choice among LED bulbs? Let me tell you how I choose. First, never buy bulbs that are rated for anything less than 25,000 hours. And never buy spares, because you'll be older before you need them, and LED bulbs will work better and cost less by then. Second, there are a lot of light bulb brands that have been around since before LED bulbs arrived, but among those, I only trust a few, and there are a couple of very long-standing brands that don't make my trusted list. Do some checking online into the major brands and the reputations of the products from each. Third, choose a color temperature that begins with a 4, usually 4,000 or 4,100 degrees. Begins with a 4. And those are for everywhere food is prepared, everywhere clothing is chosen, everywhere makeup gets applied. In the places you want to feel warmer and more relaxed, it's okay to choose a color temperature between 2700 and 3500 degrees. But where you really have to be accurate in understanding what color you're seeing, 4000 or 4100. Fourth, buy more lumens than you had before. In fact, given that the bulbs are only a few bucks each, try this. Strong recommendation here. Buy bulbs with different lumen ratings. And when you want to choose the right one for any one particular socket, just run each of them through a Goldilocks test. Too dim, too bright, or just right. Next time, I hope to find some common ground between fictional and factual when I explain how Superman sees. I hope you'll look forward to it.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the future of Windows, Thursday, August the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, September the 3rd. They meet at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group meet Thursday, September the 5th. Their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. They meet at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Computer Learning Center at Ewing meets Tuesday, September the 10th, and they meet at 2 p.m. at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road at Ewing, New Jersey. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th, and their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU in the Silver Building, room 414, located at 32 Waverly Place, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, September 13th. Their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, out in Old Westbury campus in Old Westbury, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have any computer club meetings you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.